I'm John Kroll. Coming up on No Limits, we're going to talk about money. We're going to talk about how you can make the most of your money and how you can make your money serve the life you want to lead. We're going to talk about financial planning. My guest will be certified financial planner Elaine Beadle of Beadle Financial Consulting and certified public accountant Pam Smitson of Smitson Earhart Graves Tax Advisors. Please join the conversation by calling 1-866-476-3881, emailing nolimits@wfyi.org, finding us on Facebook at nolimits@wfyi, or connecting with us on Twitter at WFYI. Now, this news.
No Limits is made possible by WGU Indiana, Indiana's 8th state university. Information about earning a degree from WGU, an accredited online nonprofit university, is available at indiana.wgu.edu. And by Apparatus, managing IT infrastructure so companies don't have to. It's advanced IT made simple. Learn more at apparatus.net.
Welcome to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We are talking today about financial planning. This is, if you have questions about how to plan for your future or how to handle your money, this is the show for you. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can do so by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimits@wfyi or on Twitter at WFYI. Well, my guests are certified financial planner Elaine Beadle, who is with Beadle Financial Consulting. Elaine, welcome to the program.
Thank you, John. Happy to be here.
It's good to have you here. And certified public accountant Pam Smitson with Smitson Earhart Graves Tax Advisors. Pam, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much, John. Very happy to be here.
All right. Well, let's start. Since the subject here is financial planning, mm-hmm. let's talk about, A, what financial planning is. I think it's mm-hmm. one of those terms that people throw out there without, you know, with varied definitions. So why don't we start out by talking about what it is and maybe what it isn't.
Okay, absolutely. I think you're right. There's a lot of definitions out there. So to get everybody on the same page, when you think of financial planning, which I think is probably one of the best and most important gifts you can give yourself or and your family, is really looking at a total picture of your finances. And that's just not your money and your investing. It is your budgeting, how you're spending your money, but it's also your income tax side of things, insurance needs analysis, education funding for children, retirement planning, estate planning, all of those things, because none of those parts should be working individually. They should all be working together. And by doing a comprehensive plan, you get a look at all of them and you make sure that everything is ticked and tied and so that it all works nicely together.
And how much, you know, most people, I think, Pam, think of taxes simply as something that you go and you file on April 15th, but obviously it's much more complex than that.
Yes, unfortunately, that is what most people do think, and that's what they wait to do, is at the end of the year, they gather the documents, take them in, and just have you to prepare the return. Also, unfortunately, in a CPA's position, they may not know your entire financial position when they're preparing your return. Mm-hmm. So it's really good to bring in not just your tax documents, but also bring in your statements that show the assets that you have, anything that your financial planner has prepared to help them to better benefit you when they're preparing your taxes.
What constitutes a good financial plan, Elaine?
Well, I think one that
in
is...
In basic terms, I mean, what are you trying to serve?
Well, I think a good financial plan basically covers whatever, and it would be considered comprehensive for that individual. And that's going to be different in every case. You know, do you need to have, you know, everyone probably needs an insurance analysis, making sure they have those things in place. They need to be looking at their income tax planning, as Pam was referencing. They need to be in charge of their cash flow budgeting, know what money's coming in and where they're spending it. And have they prepared for retirement appropriately? Are they saving enough? You know, so if you can kind of get control of the spending and make sure that you're saving toward those goals that you set set up, you know, how much you have to save in order to get there and meet that goal. Those are the important things that financial planning can really provide for someone.
How do you structure the beginning of those conversations? I mean, when somebody comes to you, what's the process?
Well, what we do is we sit down with that client and we say, okay, bring us all your information. And we do what we call a data gathering meeting. And we take their information. We say, bring us tax returns. Bring us a list of assets and liabilities. We want to know about the debts that you have. Give us an idea of what you're spending. Let us look at your estate planning documents, your wills, your trust. Bring in all of your investment accounts and those statements, again, so that we get a picture of everything. So we spend a lot of time just going through their data. And as we do that, we ask them questions about, you know, why are you doing this and what are you trying to accomplish here? And really try and get a handle on their goals, so what they're trying to do for themselves and their family. And from that, we can kind of get a great idea of the direction we need to go. But first of all, we're going to make sure that the basics are covered in a financial plan. You know, there's enough emergency fund, there's good contingency planning, so all the insurance is there that if something happens to an income earner, we've got life insurance or disability insurance, those types of things. And then you build from there. And then you start looking at the investments and putting together an investment plan that kind of makes their money do what it needs to for them.
We are talking about financial planning here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI or on Twitter at WFYI. What are the most common mistakes people make in regard? Well, I'm presuming one of them would be not having a financial plan in the first place, just sort of improvising it day after day. But we'll take that one off the table in terms of sort of if they're doing it by themselves and they think they have kind of a plan. Mm-hmm. What is the most common mistake you see, Pam?
I think there's a lot of factors that go into a good financial plan, as well as good tax planning. That they are not aware of, especially when it comes to taxes. People are not aware of all the credits and the deductions that are available, or maybe they don't want to take the time. I mean, I see a lot of people that have just did not want to take the time to gather the data to see if they can put together a return that's more beneficial for them.
What are the sorts of things that they miss most often?
A lot of times, some people will just take the standard deduction. Mm-hmm. Instead of thinking that they might be able to itemize and get more deductions on their return, they may not think about their state withholdings and their state estimates that they pay as being part of that deduction on a federal return. And so they may think, well, I don't have enough of my mortgage interest or my tax real estate taxes to justify going a long form or itemized deductions, whereas they're not thinking about they also have they have charitable deductions that they can take. They have, like I said, the state and local taxes that they can take as a deduction. A lot of times they're just not aware of that, or maybe they just are simply just not wanting to take the time to gather it.
Well, and some of that, normally I don't express an opinion on this show, but in this one I think a lot of it is because most people, myself included, approach the idea of doing their taxes with the same enthusiasm they would reserve for, say, a root canal or something. Something like that. So, you know, in that regard, they think, okay, what's going to be the quickest, easiest way to get this done? Is there, a certain income level or whatever, at which case you should really say, you know, no, I shouldn't be doing the simplified tax form. This is my situation's complex enough that I should either be getting someone who is trained in doing this work, or B, definitely I should be looking at trying to itemize it myself.
Right. Definitely, if you're in the 25% tax bracket, you're looking for
and
a professional.
Where is that? Where is that? What's the number on that?
You're talking probably around, for married filing jointly, you're talking around $72,000 to $146,000, somewhere around in there. That's the 25%.
So definitely you should have somebody doing your taxes if you're above $72,000 a year.
Unless you do not have a lot of deductions to take. If you have capital gains, if you have, it depends on what type of income it is and what type of deductions that you have. So if you just have a W-2 that has $72,000 on it, no, you probably do not need a tax professional. But if you have interest in dividends and capital gains and losses and deductions for a Schedule A, you definitely need to be talking to someone.
And Elaine, what is the most common mistake you see with people when they're trying to do financial plans on their own?
Well, I think there's a perception versus reality problem, and that usually comes with, and how much do I need to save to be able to retire and have a financially secure life after retirement? And actually, the Employee Benefit Retirement Institute out of Washington, D.C., does an annual survey, and the results are almost the same every year. When they ask workers, do you feel like you're adequately prepared for retirement, 55% say, absolutely, I'm ready to go. And then the follow-up question being, how much have you saved? And 77% of that group have saved less than $100,000. Worse than that, 50-some percent have saved less than $25,000. So the reality is you need to save much more than that. But the perception is, I'm doing well for retirement. So I think the biggest problem is people don't take the time to really determine what do they need to be saving so that they are financially secure. You know, Social Security is there. Sometimes people have a company pension, but those are going away pretty quickly. Mm-hmm. Social Security was never meant to be a lifestyle provider. It was meant to be kind of that
safety net,
right. Mm-hmm. And so the problem is people aren't thinking past, working. And if you're making $75,000 a year, you're going to have quite a bit of dollars to maintain your lifestyle. So it's a matter of calculating.
So let's use that example. If you're making $75,000
right.
a year to maintain your lifestyle, how much should you have saved at retirement?
Well, that's a good question. Let's say if you make $75,000 and you're probably spending $50,000 maybe a year. Well, if you multiply that $50,000 by 10, that's $500,000. You're going to be able to invest it, obviously, but you've got 10 years worth of principal if you save $500,000. So it's a big number that you're going to have to do. I think I was looking at, if you want a portfolio to provide you $25,000 from 65 to age 95, you need to have accumulated about $560,000. That's to be able to get $25,000 every year out of that portfolio plus inflation. And we assume that's usually 3%, to be able to provide you that for like that 30-year period in retirement. So if you wanted $50,000, you're going to need about $1.1 million. And those are kind of,
Has this gotten more complicated? Because I noticed you said from 65 to age 95,
mm-hmm.
obviously with life expectancy
right.
increasing, we used to think of retirement as that 10 to 15-year period
right.
maybe after. Are we now really looking at a 30 to 40-year window?
I think so. When we sit down with clients, we like to plan to 95. And many of the times our clients will say, I have three aunts, and they're 92, 96, and 98, and, my father lived to be whatever. So, I mean, it's just that there seems to be longevity there. And when you have somebody who retires early, some people retire as early as 55, they literally could have 40 years that they're going to need to be funding their retirement. So the longer you live, the longer you're expected to live. So it's getting to be a problem from the retirement planning side. Not a problem, but something you need to think about.
We are talking about financial planning here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI or on Twitter at WFYI. So not doing the retirement planning mm-hmm. is one of the big mm-hmm. mistakes. What are some of the others?
Well, it stems from a lot of things. What are your goals? If you have children you'd like to put through college and hopefully they don't have any debt on the other side, or at least you want to contribute something. Again, it's saving. And then saving the right way. I mean, you can get a tax credit if you use a 529 plan here in Indiana.
And what is a 529 plan? You need to explain. I realize you guys talk this stuff. But we've got an audience out there.
Right. Well, a 529 plan, it's called the College Choice. And it's an education fund where you put money into this account and it gets invested. And in the state of Indiana, to encourage you to save for your child's education, you can get up to a $1,000 credit, 20% of your contribution into the fund that year, up to $1,000. So put in $5,000, you get your full $1,000 credit on your Indiana tax return. The money sits there, and it gets invested, so it earns and it grows. And when it's used for education expenses, you never pay tax on the income. So it's a tax-free accumulating pool of funds that you can use.
And what are, yes, go
May
ahead.
May I add on to that?
Please.
Also, there are no limits as to how long that has to be in that fund. So if you have a child that's already in college, you can go ahead and make that contribution right. and turn around and take it back out for their tuition.
Run that by me again real quickly.
Okay. Your child is, if you already have a child that's in college, mm-hmm. there's no length of time that it has to be in that fund. So if you have a child that's in college currently,
so
or
you
in
can
the
start,
account,
and
yes.
it starts immediately, is what you're
correct,
saying.
Correct, okay. correct. So you, if you have a child that's in college, you can go ahead and make that contribution, get your tax credit, and then turn around and pay the tuition out of it.
We are talking about financial planning here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. My guests are Elaine Beadle of Beadle Financial Consulting and Pam Smithson with Smithson Earhart Graves Tax Advisors. I'm John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We are talking about financial planning today on No Limits. My guests are Elaine Beadle of Beadle Financial Consulting and Pam Smithson with Smithson Earhart Graves Tax Advisors. This is the show. If you have questions about how to get the most out of your money, this is the show for you. So we've talked about common mistakes mm-hmm. here. Let's suppose, I'm going to ask each of you in turn, Pam, in terms of coming up with a good tax plan, what is a good first step for somebody who's never really thought of this, has been, you know, tax preparation averse, as we talked about before, looks at it with, you know, the same sort of enthusiasm that a vampire reserves for sunlight. how should that person say, okay, I'm tired of leaving money on the table. I'm tired of making mistakes. How do I fix that?
Well, your first step would be to go to a tax professional and your financial planner. Both of them are involved in creating a good tax plan for you. It's your overall picture that matters. One thing would be to bring the last 2 to 3 years' tax returns, because your tax returns hold a lot of hints. For CPAs and for financial planners, that if you have dividends, well, we know you have something that's paying those dividends to look at. So basically, I would say just bring what information that you have in with you to your financial planner. Include your tax advisor in those conversations because it is very important for them to work together to create your overall package.
And Elaine, what's a good first step for someone who's trying to put together a financial plan?
Well, I think is to really get your information together as well. Kind of make a list of all the assets that you own, your house, your car, what investment accounts. So put that down as assets. Take away the liabilities, the debts that you owe, and come up with what your net worth is. And that's a great place to start and really starting to get organized. And then you have to think about, what am I trying to accomplish, and am I on track for doing that? And so, you know, getting that together. You know, if you don't want to use a professional, go online and use some of the calculators. There's great calculators out there for determining how much you need mm-hmm. to save in retirement and that type of thing. And, you know, I think those can get you down the road. But eventually, if you still have questions and maybe your situation's a little more complex, that's where a professional can really be helpful to you. So get yourself organized, kind of figure out where you are today and then where you want to go.
We are talking about financial planning here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. Michael, welcome to the program.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. What's on your mind?
I wanted some clarification around the tax credit from the state of Indiana. It was my understanding that if the money did not stay in for approximately 1 year, the state had the ability to request that tax credit back or to claw it back.
Good question, Michael. Thank you very much. Elaine?
Yeah, just to clarify that, what Pam was saying, you can put the money in, and then you can turn around and spend it by putting your tuition to a college. However, if you turn around and transfer it to another 529 plan, and they can tell that you're just transferring it somewhere else, then that credit will go away. But you can spend it by paying your tuition. right after you put it in.
Thank you very much for the call, Michael. Thanks. We've also gotten a Facebook message from another listener named Michael. We seem to have an abundance of Michaels here today. Says, my wife and I just got married last year in our mid-50s, no kids and middle of the middle class, and are trying to find someone to help us consolidate all our financial planning, IRAs, 401k, life insurance, annuities, etc. But it's hard to tell what the best kind of financial planner is. The fee-based planners we've talked to seem to charge pretty high fees, but others make commissions off certain products and seem to promote those products that pay them better commissions. Plus, it's very difficult to understand the fees actually charged by various funds, i.e. Vanguard, Fidelity, American funds, etc. How do we tell what direction to go? Elaine?
Well, I think that's an important question, because whenever you choose your financial advisor, your financial planner, you want to know how they're compensated. And there really are three ways of compensation. Fee only, which means that only the client pays the financial advisor. So the financial planner is not selling insurance, they're not selling any products, any investments, so no third party pays them. Then there's fee-based, which is a combination of charging a fee and then earning commissions, and then commission only, where, you know, they're maybe not charging anything for the advice that they're giving or the plan that they're making, but they're again selling you products where they earn their fund, their reward, I guess. But what I'm saying is, just as long as you understand as the client, and that is fully disclosed to you, I think is the important part, and then you can make a decision. Because you might find that the fee that you're paying to a fee-only planner may be less than the commissions you may end up paying in some of the product-oriented, or vice versa. So you just need to ask the full question and expect them to tell you. But a lot of people don't want to ask the question of how do you get paid.
Is there an industry or professional norm, you know, in terms of compensation for services? I mean, basically, is the I'm asking Michael's question in, in a different way. When should you think, you know, maybe I'm paying too much for this right now?
Well, you should always measure what are the benefits you're getting from that, and that will tell you if you're paying too much. But it really depends on someone's individual situation. How many issues are involved in the plan and how complex they are should really dictate what the price should be. Now, there are planners who will do just kind of hourly consulting, where maybe they're charging anywhere from $200 to $250 an hour just to sit down with you and kind of answer questions, and that may meet someone's needs. There are other planners who will do a very comprehensive plan, and the charges could be anywhere from a few $1,000s to $10,000, again, depending on how complex the situation is. In those situations, I would always encourage the client to ask the planner, how much will you charge me before you get started? You know, I think that's a pretty normal practice with most financial planners, is to kind of quote that fee up front so that the individual will know kind of what that cost will be so they can make that judgment.
Is it like some law firms in that the initial consultation is generally free while you're scoping things out, and then after? And some of it is defining what the relationship's going to be going forward, what level of service you expect.
And that's an important conversation. So not only ask them what kind of fees or how they're charging fees to do their work, but also what's their educational background? Are they a certified financial planner? And just get a good feel for where their area of expertise might be, and does that match up with what you think your needs are?
And is it similar to portfolio managers, too, where you can talk about, you know, performance of...
Yeah.
In some ways, is that a fair question to ask in that context?
Yes, it is. I mean, like with many financial planners, as myself, we do both financial planning and investment management. And so there's another fee charged to manage people's money, and that
and
normally
how
starts.
How does that rate structure?
That normally starts with, you know, something in the 1 to 1.5% on the first, you know, $500,000 to $1 million, and then usually declines after that. But that's a question you absolutely
so
want to ask
Gates
the planner.
So Bill Gates gets a really good deal.
Exactly, from a percentage point of view. But that's a good question to ask. And talk about the kind of portfolios they develop and what kind of returns they've had. You know, they can give you some indication of that.
And I'm going to anticipate that the next round of questions we would be in terms of tax preparation and all of that. How does the fee structure work for the accountants who are dealing with taxes?
Normally, it is on an hourly basis, although I think there are some that do charge by the form that they have to use. So, but basically, it's the hourly rate.
And what's a range of hourly rates?
Well, it depends on the level of accountant that you're working with. A lot of times we will have staff accountants that are certified, but they're new into the field, and they could charge anywhere between $75 to $125 on up to an owner of a business that may charge closer to $200 an hour. So.
We are talking about financial planning here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI or on Twitter at WFYI. Tom, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. My question is about when it comes time to take distributions from retirement accounts. You know, I've got a variety, 401k, some rollover IRAs, Roth IRAs, traditional IRAs. And when it comes time to take distributions, can I just pick and choose as to which of those accounts I want to take a distribution from, or do I have to do it pro rata?
Good question. Thank you very much for the call, Tom. Elaine.
Well, first of all, if you've got a 401k and a traditional IRAs, you can roll those together. So your 401k could be rolled into your traditional IRA to make things a little bit simpler for you. But to answer your question, you can take that minimum distribution from any pool of retirement funds there. Let me tell you, though, the Roth IRA, you do not have a requirement to take a minimum distribution from your Roth. So set that account aside and then add up what other 401ks you have and traditional IRAs. Add that number up, then go to the table, determine the factor, determine what your minimum amount is, and take that amount out of some source, one of those two or three, whatever you have, before the end of the year.
And how we've talked about the sums that, you know, like if you're single or a couple and mm-hmm. you want to be able to count on $25,000 mm-hmm. after you retire annually, you've mm-hmm. got to have $560,000
right.
saved by the time you retire. How should that be diversified? I mean, we talked about just a net sum. I'm assuming it's not so much just slapping that all in a savings account somewhere, hoping it will.
No, in fact, in that number where I said $560,000, it does assume that it's in an investment portfolio, you know, about half and half between stocks and bonds, a nice balanced portfolio. So it's earning something every year. And so that's important. Now, whether it's in a retirement account or in a non-retirement account, that's not as important. How you invest it might be. You know, there may be some instruments or some investments we put into a retirement account because of the tax deferral nature of a retirement account versus your individual portfolio. But when it comes down to retiring, if you've got that $560,000, you should be able to use those different accounts and pull out the $25,000 from wherever the most advantage comes as to pulling this out.
We've gotten a question from a listener who didn't want to go on the air, but says, for a couple considering long-term care insurance, what might the effect of the Affordable Care Act be on that type of insurance?
I'm going to take a stab at that one, Pam, and you can think about it for a
second
if you can come up to it.
Yeah.
I don't think it'll have any impact at all because, you know, long-term care insurance covers custodial care. So if you're in a nursing home and you need assistance with the, you know, six of the daily living needs, whatever that is, that requirement, Medicare does not pay for nursing home care. Mm-hmm. So it's only in the Medicaid system, which anyone who has spent down all their assets and basically are on the welfare system can use Medicaid to pay for nursing home. So I really don't think the Affordable Care Act will have anything to do. I've not seen anything that says they're going to start covering that kind of a custodial need.
Pam.
I haven't heard anything about that either, but I do want to mention on the tax side, however, that long-term care premiums are deductible. A certain portion of it is deductible based on your age.
What are the deductions that people most often miss?
Long-term care is one of them, probably. Yeah.
Well, the way you said that led me to believe that that might be.
Yes.
Are there others in terms of what you see that, you know, are things that people just leave on the table?
Surprisingly, they're investment management fees. Mm-hmm. It is subject to the 2% floor, but it of your AGI.
Okay.
Sorry.
Slow down. You're talking accountant speak.
Your adjusted gross income, which is the total of your income on page one of your tax return.
Okay.
2% of that is limited, but anything above 2% of that, if you have investment advisor fees, it is deductible on your Schedule A under miscellaneous. And a lot of people miss that.
And are there big things like the opportunities that they could restructure, say, the ownership of their house or something like that that create greater tax advantages, Elaine?
Well, not really the ownership. Doesn't matter if you're filing a joint return. Doesn't matter if it's titled in either spouse's name. So mm-hmm. on a joint return, but your mortgage interest obviously is one of those right. deductible items on Schedule A. Your property tax. You know, people probably forget, you know, some of the charitable contributions that they make if they make them, you know, throughout the year, you know, especially if they make them with cash. Mm-hmm. There's not much way to track that. So if you're making a charitable contribution, either make it with a check or, you know, a better way to do that if you've got appreciated assets is to transfer, you know, units of a mutual fund or shares of a stock to your favorite charity. Then
well,
you don't have to pay.
Why is that an advantage? I know because I'm in the not-for-profit world.
Oh, certainly. Well, it's an yeah. advantage because if you're sitting there with an investment that has gone up greatly in value from what you paid for it, you're going to pay a capital gains tax if you sell it. But if you give it away, then that capital gains tax does not apply any longer, and you still get the charitable deduction for the full fair market value, but you don't have to pay that tax. And the charity doesn't either because they're nonprofit, so they don't pay the tax.
So just to walk through using real numbers, say you mm-hmm. bought something for $2, it appreciates to $5, you decide to donate it, you get the tax deduction for the $5.
That's correct.
Even though your out-of-pocket cost was only the $2 you paid for
right.
it.
Right, right. So, you gave up the earnings, but you didn't have to pay tax on that earnings. For example, if you would have taken that $5 and cashed it out first, you may have had to pay a dollar or a dollar and a half on that, and so you would only have $3.50 or $4 left to give away. Here you gave away $5 and skipped the tax part.
We are talking about financial planning here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org, or you can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI or on Twitter at WFYI. Well, we've talked about how much money that people should have set aside for retirement, and that's something that people start thinking about probably in their late 30s and forward. I'm going to move it back a little ways so that we deal with some of the concerns and needs. And we've talked a little bit about educating children, but suppose you are a young married couple, mm-hmm. and you want to send two kids to a good college. Mm-hmm. How much money should you set aside mm-hmm. for that?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a wide range of answers there because it really depends on, are you going to a state, planning for a state institution, a private institution. So, you know, obviously the tuition cost is big difference between those two. But, you know, the best thing to do if it's before college is to set up one of the 529 plans mm-hmm. that we've already talked about and have an automatic deposit made into that account from your paycheck every mm-hmm. month or every pay or directly from your checking account. So if you would start and you would save $250 a month or even $50 a month and get it started, you'll see that accumulate nicely if you start that when they're right after they're born. I mean, so you've got 18 years to accumulate money and have it invested.
Well, let's assume then, using the range here, suppose we choose a state school mm-hmm. as one end of this and say Ivy League, I presume, would be the most expensive on the other mm-hmm. end. What's the differential? How much should you have set aside by the time junior or?
Well, if you think about an IU or Purdue, you're probably looking at about $15,000, I think, right now.
Per year.
So take that times four, you're looking at $60,000 to put one child through. And that's at today's cost. We would tell you to increase that by about 6%. Until the time your child will be in college. And that's kind of what you need. But, you know, if you had, money set aside early enough so that you can invest it and get a return, it's going to help grow. So what you need to do is kind of calculate that amount. And there are some great education calculators online where you can say, here's how much I want to have saved by the time my child is 18 years old. Or they would even tell me the kind of school you want to go to, and we'll tell you what you need to do. So there's a lot of great resources online to be able to help you with that.
How much debt should, when you're projecting for this stuff, how much debt should you look at having a child take? Because, with student loans and all of that, mm-hmm. we hear the mm-hmm. horror stories now of kids mm-hmm. coming out of school mm-hmm. and having $100,000 or $150,000.
Right.
Debt and income projections that top out somewhere around $28,000 a year.
Well, obviously, if you can do it without debt all the better. But you know, sometimes that's not possible, and actually borrowing money for college is relatively inexpensive. I mean, it's really kind of a good deal. The horror story that I've heard is people do more than their tuition, so they take out more money than they really should.
We are talking about financial planning here on No Limits. My guests are Elaine Beadle and Pam Smitson. I am John Kroll. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We are talking today about financial planning. My guests are Elaine Beadle of Beadle Financial Consulting and Pam Smitson with Smitson Earhart Graves Tax Advisors. Just before we went into the break, mm-hmm. we were talking, and because we were running into it, I think we cut off your answer a little bit about student loans and the amount of debt that young people take on when they're getting their education. Is there a guideline as to how much they should assume? Well, and then I'm going to take it from here to the whole question, the other part of the whole financial equation. We've talked about income and maintaining assets. How much debt should you carry, and what kinds of debt should you carry?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think going back to the college loan, obviously the less you have, the better for the child at graduation time. But I think there's been some real mistakes made where students can borrow money even though they don't need it for tuition. And, you know, borrowing money for the sake of having money to spend on the side doesn't make sense. I was mentioning there was a horror story told to me of a student who actually had a scholarship, didn't need it for tuition or even room and board, and ended up borrowing money and having huge debt once they graduated because they just used it for other things, personal items that they spent. So that's not a good use. It's not a good reason to borrow money for school. And actually today with education, if you get AP courses in high school, you can reduce that number of college years maybe from four down to three, which is a huge savings, you know, from college expenses.
Oh, we occasionally even see students, now these are really disciplined, hard-driving students who make it through in 2.5.
Yeah, mm-hmm. pretty
AP
amazing.
Credits and all of that.
Right.
We've gotten an email question from a listener named Faye, and if you would like to send us an email question, you can do so by sending it to nolimits@wfyi.org. She says, I currently have a 401k from a previous employer. Should I transfer that to a Roth IRA? It seems I've had the same amount of money in the 401k for years. Are there any fees if you change?
It doesn't cost you a thing to roll that 401k over to an IRA, a traditional IRA. You cannot roll it to a Roth IRA without paying income tax on all of it. Mm-hmm. So if we're assuming that everything in your 401k was done on pre-tax, in other words, you put in pre-tax contributions, it earned dollars, and then maybe your company put in some matching, all of that would be taxable if you tried to move it to a Roth IRA. So what you should do is move that to a traditional IRA, so get it out of the company into a traditional IRA.
What's the difference between a Roth IRA and a traditional
good
IRA?
Good question, yeah. John.
That's why they pay me. What
there
can
you
I
go.
Say?
Well, a traditional IRA is one that you put the money is in the traditional IRA, it earns income, and at some point in time when you pull it out, you pay tax on those dollars coming out.
Mm-hmm.
But on a Roth IRA, you put money in only on an after-tax basis, so you've already paid tax on the money going into the Roth IRA, but it earns its money on a tax-free basis. So when you start pulling money out of a Roth, you don't have to pay tax on it. So it's really beneficial from that perspective, and it's not subject to the 70.5 minimum distribution, as we learned before as well. In fact, those dollars could continue to accumulate your whole lifetime, and your kids could have a tax-free generating pool of funds as well. They could inherit it. So, but from a 401k to an IRA, and then you can move it from the traditional IRA to a Roth IRA slowly, you know, over a number of years if you'd like to do that, paying tax, again, on the dollars that you're moving over to the Roth IRA.
We've gotten a question from a listener who didn't want to go on the air on this subject, mm-hmm. said, can you roll over a Roth IRA into an existing IRA, or a 401k, I'm sorry, I misspoke.
Yes, you can roll a 401k into an existing traditional IRA. So if you've got an IRA set up, a traditional IRA set up that you've been making contributions to, because you can do that as well as your 401k, you leave your employer, you can move that 401k into your existing IRA.
But a Roth IRA, you can't, because once it moves out of the 401k to go to the Roth, it becomes taxable.
Taxable to get into the Roth.
To
now, the exception
the
to that is a lot of 401ks offer a Roth 401k portion where you can put money into the Roth portion of your 401k after tax. Putting it into your regular 401k is pre-tax. Mm-hmm. So if you put after-tax dollars into the Roth section of your 401k, then those dollars you absolutely want to transfer into a Roth IRA.
We've got a great question from a listener named DJ who says, your program today is spot on with what my wife and I went through with our new planner last week. You might discuss how the loss of a spouse can affect your retirement due to the loss of Social Security payments and why term life insurance might help that. I mean, that's the other thing that you don't want to talk about, obviously,
right.
in that case.
But that is so important to talk about. You know, when a spouse is lost, be it a husband or a wife, that the survivor is really kind of in the most vulnerable position they've ever been in, because going through the emotional stress of losing a spouse, you're not making really good decisions. And so anything can happen at that point. Bad decisions can be made. Shysters can come in and kind of do something bad with all their money. The key, I would say, is do a financial plan while you both are together and healthy, and get through that planning process so that there are no financial surprises when one of the spouses does die. And it's just real important to do that. But to answer your question,
I'll reframe DJ's a little bit, because DJ's question a little bit, because I think where I'm going is with it is, do you really need, in effect, three, if you're a married couple, three financial plans? One for if you're going to be together after retirement, and one for if each of the spouses dies.
Well, absolutely, and a good financial planner in your relationship working with them would have those contingency plans in place. So we would always say, okay, this is the plan. You're going to live happily in retirement. We prepared for it. We're ready to go. If something happens, here's where the funds come. So a lot of things happen. You lose part of your Social Security. Mm-hmm. You may lose a portion of the pension coming in, because if you're the spouse, you may only get half or some portion of what you were getting in. So it will change. And so a financial plan should take all of that into context and say, okay, if something happens, do we have enough here? And if we don't, we need to look at life insurance. We need to look at some way to fund that.
And Pam, what steps should a person take in that situation to make sure that, the estate is as protected as it can be from taxes?
Well, part of a financial plan, a comprehensive financial plan, is going to cover the estate. And it is also going to cover the estate taxes. Right now, we have the $5.25 million exemption. So unless you have more funds than that, you're probably not going to have to worry about an estate tax.
So unless you're above $5.25 million, now, does that mean you can leave it to anyone or just to your spouse?
That means that you can leave it to anyone. Yeah, I mean, it is your estate.
Right.
So
between spouses is what's called a marital deduction. Mm-hmm. So you can leave as much to your spouse without paying any federal estate tax, but that $5 million will cover it going to your children or to friends, anyone else besides your spouse as well.
And you can also carry it, or your spouse can carry what unused portion that you did not use in your estate. So each of you have the $5.2 million to utilize. And so if your spouse only used $2 million of it, then your spouse, the surviving spouse, is going to be able to use the other three.
Plus their own five.
Plus their own five, right.
We are talking about financial planning here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI or on Twitter at WFYI. We've gotten an email question from a listener named Charles who says, should I use a fee-only planner? What are the differences? We walked through this a little bit, but I guess maybe to drill down and to help Charles a little bit, What's the profile of someone who should use a fee-only planner as opposed to the two other models, really, mm-hmm. you're talking about? Is there are there certain guidelines where it makes more sense to do one or the other?
Well, first of all, the way someone is compensated is important for the client to understand, but it doesn't mean one is better than the other.
Mm-hmm.
I think with fee-only planners, you know, they tend to focus a lot on the planning and a lot on comprehensive planning, so it takes in a lot of areas. Sometimes when you're working with someone who's fee-based or commission-only, they're going to be focused on one area, and that may be fine for someone. You know, how do I save to educate my child? How do I, what should I do with this money for in my IRA? And those single topic can be very appropriate for someone who's just, you know, working through on the commission side. But I think, again, it's a personal preference, you know.
And I guess I probably ought to ask this. How does your fee structure work?
We are a fee-only firm, you know, and so that, you know, only our clients pay us. They pay us to do a financial plan, and they pay us to manage money for them. We don't get commissions from anywhere. For example, if someone needs
life. And why did you make that decision? Was it a conflict of interest kind of question, or was it a?
It was two things. I came into being a financial planner through a bank and a CPA firm, so we never sold products there. Others come into being financial planners through being brokers or insurance agents, and so they're more used to the commission side of things. It fits me better because I do like being totally without conflict. I mean, so if I tell somebody you need $1 million of life insurance, they know it's because they really do to protect their family, because I'm not going to sell it to them. I'm not going to earn a commission. And, yeah, so it's really meant to be in their best interest.
We are talking about financial planning here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. Art, welcome to the program.
Greetings. My question is, if one or both members of a couple with children have one or more different private businesses that may be service-based or products-based with more tangible assets, what types of financial planning would you suggest, and how long ahead would you need to start so that you can have it properly situated prior to something happening?
Thanks very much for the call and the question, Art. Elaine?
Are we talking about from a succession point of view, trying to figure out how to pass it between one and another? Well, a lot of that will be done through your estate plan. So in your will or in your trust document, you might say my shares of this company will pass to my spouse or will pass to my child, you know, if your child's active in the business and they want to do it. That succession planning issue, particularly with businesses, you really need to sit down and think through, because it can be a problem. If you have a business, a very successful business, maybe one of your children's involved in the business but the other isn't, well, how do you make that fair? Do you just divide the business between the one who's working there and the one who's not? Well, does that cause conflicts between them down the road? There's a lot of things you need to kind of sit down and think through. And then once you've decided how you want it to be distributed, you need to get an attorney involved so that your documents reflect that. So it does take, I think, a little bit more planning when you've got an active business that you've got when someone passes away that goes into their estate, more so than if you're just an employee for a large corporation.
At what point, you know, the cliche obviously is that if you're going to assume risk, it ought to be earlier in your working life, mm-hmm. in terms of investing. At what mm-hmm. point should you start dialing it back and thinking of a more conservative investment strategy, even with your retirement funds?
Yeah, as you're approaching retirement. You know, we would say somebody who's in.
But at what point is the approaching mm-hmm. retirement? I say this, I've had friends and colleagues who made retirement projections right around 2007, 2008,
right.
And then suddenly realized, oh, we've got a problem.
Yeah. Well, what you want to think about when we design a portfolio for someone, we start out with how much money do you need from this portfolio?
Mm-hmm.
To fund your needs for the next 5 years. Now, for someone who's actively working, they say zero. I don't need anything from this portfolio in the next 5 years, which means we can be pretty aggressive in leaving it there. But if someone says, okay, in the next 5 years, I'm going to be retired. I'm going to need, you know, $50,000 a year. So that's $250,000, 50,000 times five, that we want to set in a fixed income side of the portfolio. In other words, bonds, CDs, those types of vehicles. And the rest of it then can be in the stock market, which is going to be much more aggressive and carry a higher risk. The reason we say 5 years is because if you put something in the stock market and the market goes down, it usually takes about 5 years for it to come back up. So we want to be able to protect our clients and say, okay, we've got your 5 years of distribution sitting over here in something much more stable that doesn't fluctuate nearly as much as the stock market. So if the market goes to hell in a handbasket, we can just sit here and use our fixed income side up. And then when the market comes back up, we can reallocate and always do that. So we always want 5 years of distributions in the fixed income side. So that's kind of what tells us how we should allocate between the higher risk going into the stock market, but that's where you get your growth, versus the fixed income side.
Pam, what if I'm a person who doesn't want to retire? I mean, you know, how long can I shelter, you know, keep the money in the, is there a point when I have to take it out and subject it to taxes?
Yes. IRAs, they require minimum distributions when you reach 70 and a half. I believe they have to be taken out by the April 1st of the year that follows your turning 70 and a half. Again, they are a combination of all the traditional IRAs that you own. Roth IRAs, like Elaine mentioned, you do not have to take minimum distributions from those, but you are going to have to start taking distributions as you reach that retirement age. That was the entire purpose of the tax benefits that you received, was that sometime down the road, you're going to have to pay those taxes on that.
Chuck, welcome to the program.
Withdrawal. How do you find the calculator for how much you have to withdraw once you turn 70 and a half? And a second question, what's the deadline for transfer from a traditional to a Roth IRA for 2013?
Thanks very much for the call and the question, Chuck.
To convert from a traditional IRA to a Roth IRA, you need to do that before 12/31. So before the end of this year for 2013, you need to make whatever amount you want to transfer.
You got 12 days, basically.
Yeah. If you do it after the year, then it falls in 2014 taxes. If you do it before the end of the year, it'll be in your 2013 taxes. But it has to be done before the end of the year. It's not something you can just wait and do before your tax return's filed. It has to be done.
Pam, since we are at the close of the tax year, we've got 12 years, even though people sort of associate it with April, what sorts of things should you be thinking about right now if you're, you know, and talking with your tax preparer or accountant about?
Well, there are a number of things that you can still do. I know we were talking about, I think before we went on the air, of harvesting some capital losses possibly to offset some of the gains that you've had. You can think about your charitable distributions. We're all giving at the end of the year. Be sure that you have your receipts for those. Gathering your information is just critical to be able to decide what movements that you need to make, what you need to do to save your tax dollars there.
We've gotten a question from a listener who didn't want to go on the air. It says, talk about advantages and disadvantages of survivor bonds. It says, mother is in her late 80s and is trying to be talked into survivor bonds. Do you know the term, or is it?
I'm not sure if they're talking about U.S. savings bonds or what they're referring to. I'm not sure. Maybe if that listener can call back in and give us definition of what they're referring to as survivor bonds.
Well, and actually, I think we are, unfortunately, into the program. But given the number of questions we have gotten about these subjects, I think we're obviously going to have to do this show again and continue the conversation at some point. I would like to thank you both. Elaine Beadle, I'd like to thank you. It's been a pleasure talking with you.
Thank you.
Pam Smitson, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
I hope you both have a wonderful holiday season. And I hope that for everyone who was listening to the program, I am John Kroll. You've been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Producer, Sharon Alseth. Interactive Media Coordinator, Melissa Davis. Technical Producer, Jeanette Rhodes. And Board Engineer, Don Hibschweiler. We invite you to join us each week for No Limits, made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.